98% pure potato.
98%
pure potato. Well, hello and welcome to the latest episode of 98% Pure Potato. This is John Griffith speaking. This week I thought I'd talk about a particular section of the book, which is called Left Brain, Right Brain and the Higher Powers. One of the things which is, I think, comes through quite strongly in the book is that even though this was years before the terminology of left-brained analytical thinking and right-brain creative thinking had come to the fore, in fact, person who came up with the idea and he got his Nobel Prize for it in the 80s. But it was very obvious from the start that the planners needed to be able to do both. It wasn't enough simply to get people who are highly rational and could deduce and could out-argue if you didn't also have the ability to make creative leaps. And this is one of the things that comes through reasonably strongly, as a lovely quote at the start of the chapter from Jim Williams, who came to BMP after dropping out of postgrad in physics in Oxford, but because he was spending too much time in the playhouse acting or being involved in dramatic productions. So you've got that lovely combination of the scientist and the artist. Now, what I was interested in is not only that one has this combination, and it is a spectrum, and you will have some people who are far more intuitive and you have some more people who are far more rational. However, the best is where they're combined. But what was really useful from these interviews, because we asked people to say who they rated and why they rated them, to discover what are the higher planning powers. What is it that raises people above merely being brilliantly analytical and brilliantly creative to being able to work at a higher level even than that? This is the list that we identified, and I'll just take you through this. The first kind was terriers, the people who just don't give up. It was this idea of people being able to go out and build a case and to turn over every stone until they got there. And that obviously involves a fair amount of hunting around, but the main thing is not being distracted. It's this ability to focus and to keep going till you get to the thing that you wanted to do. So that was one example that we were given, and it described several of the people who were regarded as really, really good planners. The second one is the planner as a listener. And the two examples of this that come to mind are the late Doug Richardson, he died just a year after I interviewed him, who was called the Zen Planner. And also John Steele, whose books you probably know about. But what both these planners had in common was that they were confident enough, or maybe unconfident enough, to stay silent for entire meetings while they were thinking and coming to a conclusion. So they didn't feel the pressure to have to contribute, even if they didn't have an opinion or they actually had nothing to say. So in the example of John Steele, what he would do is to sit and listen to really understand the different viewpoints that the different people in a work group had. And once he'd understood those, he would go and address the particular issues with them after the meeting and often get to a far more productive result, even though he'd actually said nothing in the meeting. In the case of Doug Richardson, it was much more a question of not knowing what he thought, and so therefore appearing to have zoned out. In fact, he was called the Zen Planner because he fell asleep so often. He claims he didn't, but everyone else says he did. And it was just a way for him to be participating in what was happening while he formed his own opinion. And the reason why that's important is that when he then did come to a conclusion, it was a good one, and he had taken on board all the opinions that he'd heard stated rather than diving in and having to defend his position versus everyone else's. So that's the second one, of the listener. The third one is the spare pair of hands, the idea of the person simply being useful. So in other words, rather than go diving in there, cracking the problem and then out-arguing everyone to try and win your point of view, It's the idea that the planner is there to be helpful. And this came from John Steele again, and also from Jeff Howard Spink, who for much of his career, before he became the head of planning at Low Howard Spink, his own agency, was a suit. And so in that regard, he just thinks your job is to get alongside the creatives and to be useful, not in that sense to be some intellectual bully that's bossing them around. So that spare pair of hands one. I think also, picking up on something that Adam Lurie said, that there's a cult of intellectualism in with planners, which is actually quite unhelpful because it's focusing on the wrong things. And planners often find themselves wheeled into meetings precisely because they're the brainy one, and that will either impress the client or shut the client up. That doesn't necessarily mean you carry the day. So cleverness is useful, but don't overdo it. So this spare pair of hands is really a way of saying be useful, be practical, and if your intellect is helpful, then use that, but don't hide behind it. Then we come on to a higher level still beyond that, in my judgment at least, which is those people who are the super persuaders, the people who are good at persuading others to share their opinion. And this tended to be where the women planners were particularly effective, because they weren't trying to win. There was less testosterone. And there's a comment by Lee Godden specific to that point, that the men would be more dogmatic, whereas the women were classic negotiators and would find a way through that everybody was happy with. But I think it's also, it's the ability to empathise. There's a lovely account of Ev Jenkins sitting down with a group of clients and talking about their kids, and then talking about work in general, the work which they did for much of the week, which has nothing to do with advertising, and only then coming on to the advertising problems and getting much more satisfactory outcomes because she was trusted and they talked through all the other things. So it was much more like a chat where one was taking people with them. And Jane Newman gives a similar account of putting a flagpole up as a goal, and then almost like a sheepdog, bringing all the people with you to head for that single goal, rather than to somehow race there and shout at people because they're not catching up with you. It's very much taking people with you. So that's the persuading of people as a higher planning power. And the last one that I wanted to mention was something from Paul Felwick, where his comment was that he wasn't even sure it was a planning skill. However, all the best planners had it. And what he described is this ability to sit back and to listen carefully, but to improve however one went about doing it, through contributing or perhaps through not, to improve the quality of the conversation that was being had. And I thought that was very insightful and one of the most profound things that came out of doing the interviews and writing the book. The idea that it's not simply there about picking an idea and getting everyone to line up behind it, but that it's helping everyone, whether inside the agency or within the client team, to understand what they're doing and to do it better, and to make sure that in the discussions that these aren't a series of battles or ego contests, but a way of having a discussion about what the communications has to do, which takes other people there, but actually has a much better outcome, because people have a better understanding as not only as to where they've got to, so they're far more likely when they do other related work to go back to it and to do it well and accurately, but to understand how they got there and to produce a better result. That's the last higher order of planning skill, which is to improve the quality of the conversation. I think I'll leave it there for this week.